I'm Christopher Lydon with the two-time Pulitzer Prize reporter Anthony Shadid. Prizes for his newspaper coverage of our war in Iraq going in 2003 and then coming out in 2009. He's an Arab-American with family roots in Lebanon and an Oklahoma boyhood behind him too. All of it shows up in his coverage. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Anthony Shadid won his Pulitzer Prizes for his work in the Washington Post. He's on his way back to the Middle East for the New York Times. We catch him in the Switch in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he and his wife, Netta Bakri, also a Times correspondent, have just had their first baby. Anthony Shadid, such a pleasure to see you. I want to know what's on a man's mind going back to the Middle East. Will we ever get that story straight? We readers, but even you reporters.
There are several chapters, I think, that you find in the Middle East where, the conclusion just hasn't been written yet. And, you know, it always struck me, I think in particular with Baghdad, you know, making the decision to go back there. I had been away for a couple of years, but, you know, it's often frustrating to me or even irritating, I think, as a journalist, when you get to see the powers that be, those with the greater power, that they have the ability to write the narrative. And the narrative, I think, was being written back in 2008 and 2009 was that the war was over in Iraq. And I found that very frustrating because, you know, perhaps the war was over. Perhaps this war that we understood in 2005, 2006, you know, had come to an end. But I thought in saying that, we missed what the legacy of this war was or the way that this war was still playing out in different ways. And, you know, I felt there were so many of us as journalists there in 2003 to watch the beginning. I mean, in fact, there were hundreds of us. But you look back in 2009, there was, you know, a handful, you know, maybe a couple dozen at most. And I felt like, you know, as journalists, we couldn't abdicate our responsibility to actually say how this is going to turn out. What are the Americans going to leave behind? What is this war going to leave behind on that country?
The mark of your reporting, it strikes me, and it's quite unusual, is the sensitivity to nuance of the Arab world. This is not your basic green zone, the general said today, or body counts or stuff. You're on the ground. In your book on the first round in Iraq, Night Draws Near, you wrote about the reflexive Arab habit of standing when somebody enters the room. And there's all sorts of touches like that in your new work.
You know, I'm probably going to go out a little bit on a limb with this and saying this, but I think it is an important point to make. And I think what we've seen, you know, we're entering almost a generation of conflict between, I mean, however you want to define it, the Arab world and the United States, West and East, however we want to describe it. But it is almost a generation-long conflict. And I think part of any conflict, in order to perpetuate that conflict, there has to be a certain dehumanization that goes on. And I think in the West, we have dealt with a certain dehumanization of the Arab world.
Let's talk about it.
You know, it was very frustrating to me before the invasion in 2003. And, you know, as a reporter, as somebody that was trying to write the narrative against that in some ways, I found as my job is to, it could be very simple things. You know, anytime someone was killed that I was going to report about or write about, I wanted to make sure that I was going to have his name or her name, their age, the circumstances of their death. Something as simple as having the name and the age that you put a face to a death. I thought, you know, at least perhaps it's meaningless, but it's just one small gesture against that, I think, that dehumanization that's going on. I think when you put that into a bigger context of a body of work or, you know, a longer period of journalism, I think it is you find these, I tried to do this more in 2003, but you find these common points, these intersections between, you know, Iraqis and Americans, say, or between people living in the West or East, you know, be it a father who loses his son in a bombing, you know, a mother who sends her son off to fight in war. I think there are common emotional experiences that we are going to share regardless of where we are, and I often found that as a way to kind of center the reporting and the writing around. The experiences aren't all that unfamiliar, and I think, you know, there is often a tendency to exoticize the Arab world or perhaps make it something that is so unfamiliar. It is in some respects. It is, you know, these are two cultures that often don't share the same space, but at the same time, I think they often share more than we probably let on, you know, the narrative in the Middle East these days is often suffering and tragedy, and that those are two things that we're very well can understand living here in the States.
I'm thinking of one story, for example, from the Sunni Triangle. It was a throwaway line, but you had it in the story that lunch for a stranger, any stranger, was requisite. First lunch.
That's right. There is absolutely a sense of hospitality. I think we've lost in the United States to some degree. Although I think you find, I mean, growing up in Oklahoma, it was much more familiar to me. And in the Middle East, you know, lunch was obligatory. If you go to somebody's house, you are going to have lunch. When you walk into a room, someone is going to stand up and they're going to say hello. Walking in, you know, passing somebody in the street, there is going to be some, you know, a few words that are going to be exchanged. You still have that in Oklahoma, which is always refreshing when I go back and see that. But I think in some, you know, in other places in the United States, we've lost that. That hospitality, I think, is one of the things that, you know, when I say this to friends in the U.S., people find, you know, they kind of, they're taken aback perhaps a little bit. But, you know, when I think of the Arab world or when I think of the Middle East, those are the things I think of, the warmness of the culture, the hospitality, you know, what makes it still a very gentle place in a lot of respects.
I mean, to extend the point, though, maybe to challenge you, though, but you write about the unforgiving ways of the desert hold sway. A lot of reporters wouldn't dare say that.
You know, they might not. And I'll tell you, I think that the story we were talking about was one of the most tragic stories that I dealt with in Iraq, and it's one that still reverberates today. And this is when a father was forced to kill his son. And it's interesting that you brought that up.
For informing to the Americans.
Working as an informer on the Americans. And it's interesting you brought that up in this context, because I think it actually is one of those stories that, you know, at the time, well, I'm not sure if I got it wrong, but I think the way it was received was not the way I had meant to write it. And this father was forced to kill his son. His son was an informer for the Americans, and the villagers, the tribal leaders in that village said, you know, either you kill your son or we're going to kill the rest of your family. So this father had to make that choice. When I wrote that story, it was on the front page of the Washington Post. I think the reaction by most people here in the States was, look at the, you know, this is a barbaric place. This is a place we can never understand. We can never understand how unforgiving it actually is. That wasn't the point. The story actually was something different, was far different, in fact. And what I wanted to understand through that story is how, by the Americans intervening in this tiny village, you know, a footnote to the war, if even that, they reoriented this village. They set into motion a sequence of events that transformed that village for a generation. Just that one act of entering into the village, that armed intervention by the Americans. It's not the way the story was understood or received, and it's probably my fault for not writing it clearly enough that way, but I got a chance in 2009 to go back and write it that way and write what happened in that moment, 2003, when the Americans set foot in, and what happened 6-7 years later. You know, what I think is, I mean, I tell you, probably some of this is going to sound contradictory because there's so much to talk about, but, you know, I think what is actually happening in the Middle East these days is something transformational. I'm talking more about politics here than, you know, the hospitality and the lighter stuff that we were discussing. I think when we do talk about politics, there is a transformational moment going on in the Middle East, and it's something that I want to understand, that just me personally wants to try to make sense of. And it's a great way, I think, to kind of orient the journalism when you yourself have a question to answer, and that then becomes the journalism itself. It happened in Iraq, I did it in Lebanon, and here's another chance to do it. This notion of identity in the Middle East, how people define themselves, are they Arabs, are they Muslims, are they Egyptians, are they, you know, however people identify themselves first and foremost, I think has a huge bearing on the politics of the place. And that notion of identity, I think, in the past, you know, 10 or 20 years has undergone a fundamental shift. You know, that sounds kind of academic the way I'm describing it, but I think it has a bearing on everyday life. And I want to
Anthony, where would you
that.
Go looking for it?
Well, I'll tell you, the what's been making me think so much about it is I had taken a year off in 2007 and 8 to go rebuild my family's house, the ancestral home in southern Lebanon. And it turned out this small village was one of the best, you know, I hate to use the word laboratory, but it was one of the best places to see how this identity actually was transforming, as being transformed.
Would you tell us that story of refinding and rebuilding, in a sense, that house?
You know, it was 2006, and the war between Israel and Hezbollah had ended in August of 2006. I had been to my grandmother's home before, but on this day, actually the day after the ceasefire, I was in a village across the valley and decided to take the trip back to my grandmother's home. You know, I found that war one of the most brutal things to cover. I mean, obviously I came out fine and I was not hurt, but, you know, the suffering that did go on during that war, I found it a sadistic war at some level, and, you know, I was kind of worn out. And I remember sitting at my grandmother's home after that war had ended, and I just made a decision then that, you know, it was time to get away from some of this, you know, this kind of war correspondence or war reporting, and do something that maybe was a little more gentle. And I decided to rebuild her house. And somehow I managed to get a year off from the Post to do that. And I spent that year in this town, Marjayoun, rebuilding her house and then later writing a book about that experience. And, you know, trying to understand you know, something bigger. And this is something, again, that comes back to this question of identity that I just mentioned. It's what's been lost in the Middle East. You know, this kind of older notion of the Middle East that was perhaps more tolerant, perhaps more cosmopolitan, perhaps more liberal, how that's been lost and why it's been lost. And I keep coming back to this question of identity, this notion of identity. But I think it's something that goes, you know, even beyond that.
What about your own? In what sense are you building out your own sense of who this second-generation Arab American is up to in this globalizing world?
You know, it's so fun to go back. I mean, my idea, and again, it was kind of a naive one, extremely naive, was I was going to go back to this, you know, this ancestral town and be welcomed as, you know, as the, you know, the lost son, and be embraced by everyone in the village. And I'd say about halfway through my time there, I ended up just hating the place. I couldn't stand it. It's just, you know, I wanted to get out. I was trying to find a way to just lock the house up, forget about the repairs, and go back to Beirut.
What did one hate about it?
Well, you know, it's a village, and I think a village, you know, it's a small place, and there's a lot of gossip, and there's a lot of suspicion, and you know, all this kind of comes down on you. And of course, when you're there alone, it becomes magnified. And you know, at one point, there was a magazine that had come out. It was a monthly, or even I think every 3 months, a magazine. And the village is not the fair; it's a town, but it comes out every 3 months. And on the cover was, you know, people in the town respond to Anthony Shadid's criticism of Brother Shane Yun. And there I am on the cover of this place, cover of this magazine. I had no idea that, you know, this was even going on. So, you know, later on, I actually came to terms with, you know, not only my relationship to the town, but I also, you know, maybe a better notion of, you know, your own sense of self. And that's, you know, to hyphenate ourselves is often too limiting. You know, we're that and so much more. And I think I got a chance to appreciate that, you know, I wasn't from this town anymore. I just wasn't. I had a history. My family had a history there. I probably wanted to be part of it more than I was part of it. But I think in the end of that stay there, after a year, it became clear to me that we kind of create our own notion of place or community, you know. And this, you know, this Marjayun that I wanted to go back to, I could never go back to, but I could in some ways create my own Marjayun. And I think that's what you do, and you know, through house, through friends, through community, through the people you want to be around. And you know, that's what I managed to do in the end.
I wonder, as you speak, do you know Amin Maalouf?
I do.
I mean, he came from a small Lebanese Christian town, lived through the 70s civil war around the Palestinians, repaired to Paris, has written brilliantly about identity. Killer identity is what he calls it, and the fundamental notion that once you can reduce, especially somebody else's identity, to a word, you're about to kill them, or maybe get killed. But that maybe Lebanon is a perfect place to rethink these labels, the complexity of identity, the changeability of identity.
Absolutely. One of my favorite stories about that, and I think, you know, Maalouf makes a great point of that when you reduce it to one word. You know, one of my favorite stories of how kind of almost comical it can be was a friend of mine in this town, Marjayun, became friends when I was staying there for a year. He was telling me a story about the Civil War. You know, when he was stopped at a checkpoint, it was a Muslim checkpoint. This friend of mine was Christian, but he wasn't just Christian, he was Protestant. So they're looking at it, the militiaman who was Muslim was looking at his passport, and he looks at this thing and he's like, Protestant, you know, what's this Protestant thing? So he asked his commander, he's Protestant, should we kill him? And the commander goes, no, they're killing Catholics in Ireland, you should let him go. So he got a pass. He was, you know, and I mean, this idea that he almost died because of one word or one notion of identity, which doesn't even describe him or define him. But I think Lebanon is one of those places that, you know, more so than any other place I've been in the world, you know, once you, especially if you have roots there or you have ties to it, once you're there, if you are Greek Orthodox, Maronite Catholic, Druze, you know, Shiite Muslim, Sunni Muslim, you are automatically defined, and that definition is going to determine what your politics are, what your social life is like, where you, you know, what you think about the world. And it's almost suffocating, claustrophobic in a way, and I think it's become more so. And you notice that, I mean, I felt that especially in this town where I spent the year. My ancestral town was, you know, a place that used to be full of communists and nationalists, and they'd, you know, spill into the streets and start fighting after a few drinks. You know, this is 30, 40 years ago. Today, it's basically just been reduced to this idea that they're Christians and nothing else. And that, I think that's such a limited notion of identity in some ways, I mean, in my mind at least, kind of, you know, augurs their extinction.
Anthony Shadid, you won the Pulitzer just weeks ago for your 2009 coverage of Iraq. And I've been through it pretty carefully again. The overwhelming impression for me is that we Americans, stateside, have barely the faintest idea of the damage to that place. not just the destruction, but this unleashing of the most gruesome kind of violence that feels barely human, and then the toxicity of all of it just kind of leaking through the ground. It may never be cleaned up.
I think that's a great way. And toxicity, I think, is a great word to use. I find it almost painful to come back to the States sometimes. And at times you will hear this narrative: we won the war, the war was won, or somehow we managed to.
It's okay now.
Defeat the insurgents. You wonder if this isn't the lesson that people are going to take away. Perhaps in the future, is that we figured out how to win a war like this. I mean, when you're in Baghdad itself, I think it's almost overwhelming, the sense that this society has been broken, that the fabric the fabric that was there in this country has been torn apart, and you wonder how it can be, sewn back together, if it can. It's often a subject of conversation with Iraqi friends there. How long is it going to take before we can even hope of recovering? 40 years, a few generations. You most often hear that this generation is lost. Everyone you meet there has lost a relative or a friend to the violence, every single person. And I mean, I think when you think about that, just the scope of that kind of bloodshed, it's breathtaking. And that was, part of what I wanted to kind of grasp in 2009. Again, this administration or the last administration can declare the war over, but it's not over, and its legacy is not over, and it's going to, like you said, it's going to, bear itself out for years and years to come. How do we make sense of it?
We also blame, and everybody blames, the 80s and the war with Iran for immense brutalization of a population. But when you think of what we Americans ought to know, take to heart, remember, what are the stories you think of, or the people?
I think if in the most general sense, it is that it's a traumatized place, and it's been traumatized by, like you pointed out, the war with Iran, obviously the rule of Saddam Hussein, American intervention time and again, these bombings that, Americans thought they were going to go there who knows what they thought they were going to go there as, but some often said as liberators. And anybody who had spent any time there knew that was foolish at best, that it was too complicated a legacy to make sense of that. I remember sitting at lunch with friends, acquaintances really at the time, but sitting at lunch with them, and the bombing had just started a few days before. And these people weren't by any means admirers of Saddam Hussein, but just because you're not an admirer of Saddam Hussein didn't make you a fan of the Americans or an admirer of the Americans either. There is still a sense of pride, a sense of independence. No one wants to be invaded or occupied. And I think that the very simple notion was never quite understood here. And it's true.
Why not? I wonder.
I think it's there is just this probably sounding too judgmental in saying this, but I think there's often a streak of arrogance and ignorance in American foreign policy that's really troubling. And I think it often plays itself out in the Arab world because it reminds you of like almost a missionary's approach to, we're going to, make this place better. We're going to show them how to, be more just and more, fair. And even today in Iraq, I think when you see the press releases that are put up at the embassy and the military, there is such a sense of condescension and how they, and the way that they're preaching to Iraqis or preaching to anyone in the Arab world at this point. Just to go back to this one point, I'll never forget standing in that, in Saadun Street, the day that Saddam fell, the day the Americans arrived. And again, this narrative was, and I think a lot of people, even Iraqi expats, were portraying this as they were going to be welcomed with, flowers and rice. And even that day, I remember the tanks had stopped, and I was just going down the street interviewing people one after the other, trying to get a sense of, how are people taking, here Baghdad has fallen. I mean, it was almost this epic moment where Baghdad, the capital, this capital that's, I think much more meaningful in history than it was, perhaps in the present, but, Baghdad had fallen. And we're going down the street, and there were some people that were jubilant, absolutely. But I think there were probably a third of the people I talked to, and then there was a third of the people that were outraged. And I remember the American soldiers had thrown these, they call them MREs, meals ready to eat. They had these prepared meals. They had thrown them at people. And I remember one or two people had actually picked them up and thrown them back at the Americans, how dare you insult us. And then I think a third of the people were like, let's wait and see how this turns out. And of course, it turned out very badly in the coming days. But even at that one moment, it was such a mixed kind of sentiment, such a, conflicted sentiments, and so ambiguous and nuanced. And, I think that ambiguity and that nuance carried itself through the years and until today.
Right. I kept wondering, we wouldn't have thought of ourselves as liberating Frenchmen or Germans or Venezuelans or Africans by these means. And there is some sort of cliche formula that that reassures us, oh, this is the way we deal with Arabs.
Yeah.
I wonder where it came from. I wonder how you feel it. I wonder how you think of your journalistic mission to bend it, to change it.
You know, it's a great point. I actually haven't thought of it in those terms, but I think you're exactly right. And I, you know, I looked back, I think, like I mentioned earlier, there is this tendency to make, you know, I don't know what it is, but it's not something that just the past few years, this idea of making the Middle East so exotic, exoticizing it. I mean, you know, the Ottoman capital was never the High Gate, it was the Sublime Porte. I mean, this like exotic language and the way we understood things and the way we'd read these character traits in the Arab world into the, you know, these, you know, millennia old attributes and, you know, these essential qualities. And it's all, you know, to me it's all silliness. I mean, it's, you know, we're dealing with this very modern place with, you know, modern traumas and modern conflicts that have shaped that, you know, shaped Iraq. I mean, Iraq, you know, Iraq has been a frontier for thousands of years, no question about it. And, you know, and Iraqis themselves talk about how this frontier has shaped their personality. But I think we're looking at Iraq and how this country is today. We have to understand that, you know, the past two generations of conflict there that have shaped it. You know, why, and beyond that exoticization, I think it goes back to that idea of dehumanization, is that we have been in conflict with the Arab world for a long time. It's something that, you know, dates, you know, to Israel's creation, basically, in 1948 on, and it has this conflict between West and East, between the United States and the Arab world. Just by, you know, in order to perpetuate that conflict, there has to be a certain amount of dehumanization, and I think it's infected not only relations between the two, but also the coverage by journalists like, you know, like my colleagues and me.
Can you see an end to it?
I don't see an end to it until, I mean, I know here I'm putting myself in the place of pundit, and I hate to do that, but, you know, I think people who work there or live there in the Middle East understand that this conflict between Israel and Palestine simply has to come to an end. I mean, talking about toxicity, this is the toxic conflict in the region, and until it ends, I think we're just, you know, we're just hell-bent on, you know, more years of strife and conflict, you know, that serve no one.
General Petraeus seems to have concluded that.
Yeah, I tell you, and it's, you hear, like, you'll hear Petraeus say this, you'll hear, like, you know, Zinni, I mean, Anthony Zinni, another general who knew the region pretty well. You do keep hearing this, but then you wonder how, you know, how many administrations have, you know, eventually maybe reached that conclusion, how much diplomatic capital has been invested in solving that conflict, and that conflict still goes on. And I find that just spectacular, to be honest, that it's still, that, you know, I'm 41 now. First time I was in the, you know, I was there as a college student when I was 19, and it's the same conflict. I mean, in some ways changed, but in some ways unchanged, and we're still dealing with it, and it's kind of, you know, how it poisons the region all these years later. It's just remarkable to me.
You know David Greenway, the Boston Globe. I was saying to him the other day, it reminds me of a passage in Les Misérables where Victor Hugo relives the Battle of Waterloo, and he has a sort of acre-by-acre analysis of troops here, troops there. And he ends up saying, it wasn't the Duke of Wellington, it wasn't about Napoleon, it wasn't about the peasant who redirected in the wrong way, it wasn't about the weather, it wasn't about the Prussians who didn't get there on time. What decided the Battle of Waterloo was that God was tired of Napoleon, and he had to clear him out to make way for a great new century. And I said to David, you know, I think that's what is on Petraeus's mind. Like, enough already, get that little piece of real estate done, and we've got to get on with some bigger stuff.
Huh, interesting. You know, you can almost see Petraeus. I mean, Petraeus does seem to think what's the word I'm looking for? Ambitiously, let's say. You know, I wonder. I think if... I have to say, I find myself, you know, as much as I still enjoy living in the Middle East and enjoy, you know, it's where I want to live, I find myself often very pessimistic and sad these days. And not about, again, you know, I don't think it's fair to read in anything to culture and, you know, these essential qualities of a people or of a place. But I think the modern conflicts have just so disfigured the Middle East right now that it's tough to have a lot of hope about what's ahead. And I think Iraq has just been the latest, most miserable chapter in that, and in many years of that conflict.
Let's go back to Thuluia, if I pronounce it right. Uh-huh. It becomes your sort of capsule, a town on the Tigris in the Sunni Triangle, thick with Baathists and Sunni Arabs, a Saddam Hussein stronghold in a certain way. You use it to tell the story of 8 years. Can you give us the capsule?
Sure.
The capsule of the capsule.
Yeah. If I can just go back, because 2003, again, that was the time I wrote the first story about the father forced to kill his son. And I'll never forget what the father told me. I think to this day it remains words. I mean, they almost send a, you know, they're chilling, I think. And they're still chilling when I even think of them. And he told me, we were sitting in his house. He had tried to kill his son. He had shot his son, but his son didn't die. And then his other son had to fire the last shot that killed his brother. Anyway, the father said to me, you know, not even the prophet Abraham had to kill his son. There was no other choice. And, you know, for some reason, that idea of not having a choice, of this choice being forced on him, like I said, it did haunt me. And I got more frustrated, I think, as the years went on, because it was part of my book, Night Draws Near. You know, I didn't think, and I tried to get it right in Night Draws Near, but even then I didn't think I got it exactly the way I wanted to. And that was, again, coming back to this point that, you know, the Americans had entered this town. They were there for 2 or 3 days. They never came back in force like they had this in this initial foray back in May of 2003. And they had set into motion all of these dynamics, these forces that were far greater than them and that transformed this place. And, you know, by 2009, I think in some ways we saw, but it's still going on. But it was interesting to go back in 2009 and kind of see things go full circle in a way. The tribal elders who had forced the father to kill his son then gave him protection against the Americans. The Americans had come after this father, trying to prosecute him for doing it. He had to flee. Then he was protected by the tribe. You know, Al-Qaeda emerged in the town and was then vanquished, and the person who vanquished them was actually one of them in the beginning. He himself was a fascinating character, Mullah Nazem, who I found out just recently has been forced to leave the town himself, and now he's gone.
Not Nadim Khalil.
It's the same person. Nazem Khalil.
Different name.
And he goes by Mullah Nazem. That's kind of his nickname in the town. Everybody
Tell
knows him as Mullah Nazem.
Tell his story, because he was everywhere. Young cleric, about 30, and he is compromised every way. Joins Al-Qaeda, but he ends up fronting for the Americans too. And there's a parable, among other things, of both of the violence and of the kind of susceptibility to corruption of maybe all of us, but certainly those people in those years.
Absolutely. In fact, I think he remains the most remarkable figure I met in Iraq until now. Mullah Nazem, or Nazem Khalil, was this person. Even during, he inherited this mosque from his father and from his grandfather. It was a line of clerics. He was very young. He was in his early 20s when I first met him. Mm. He had inherited, he served as the preacher at this mosque under Saddam and was known as a critic of Saddam Hussein, known as a critic of the government of the Ba'ath Party. He even got in some trouble at the time. The Americans invaded, the occupation began, and he became very soon, you know, a forceful opponent of this. Now, when I met him back in 2003, he said he was only fighting with his tongue, as he put it. He soon became a fighter, joined Al-Qaeda, and helped impose his reign of terror, basically, on the Luwayya, where people were, you know, everything from being, smoking was banned in the streets to if you were joining the police, you were executed with, you know, sometimes beheaded by the dull end of a shovel. It was just an awful period in that town's history. Mullah Nazem was the person that was, if not leading it, he was the force behind it. He then saw the excesses, saw how people had turned against Al-Qaeda, and decided that he himself would turn against them. He joins the Americans. They vanquish Al-Qaeda. Mullah Nazem emerges as a strong man in the town, basically. And then, again, it just shows you how, you know, what I was struck by this town is how things, in some ways, returned to the way they were before the invasion itself. The kind of power shifted a little bit in the Luwayya. Mullah Nazem was arrested on charges of murder. He was forced out to some extent. The Americans abandoned him, clearly abandoned him. They said they had nothing to do with him anymore, even though he'd fought with them only a year before. And now, like I said, what I've heard is that Mullah Nazem actually had to flee the village. And what you have is, in such a striking way, is that in 2009, the power is back in the hands of these tribal elders, the same elders that forced his father to kill his son. In some ways, it had come full circle after all this trauma, all this bloodshed, all these events that have been set into motion by the American intervention in the very beginning of the war. And now we're back to the way it was in the beginning.
I keep wondering, Anthony Shadid, who else is keeping score on this besides you? I mean, we have no idea of this story, that the more things change, the more they're the same. That we've been through most of a decade now, incredible destruction, and for what?
And I wonder how many, this story, I mean, the Luwayya, the only reason I even found out about this is we went to follow up on this American, raid on this town back in May of 2003, and friends of friends, and, you heard this conversation, and you found this, and you realized you needed to kind of stick with it and see how it turned out, but it was just luck that we kind of, even got a chance to really understand this village and what happened in this village, you wonder how many of those stories are playing out in so many different places in Iraq day after day, year after year, stories that will never be told. And that, I think, that haunts me, I think, as a journalist, is that there are so many stories that will never never be heard, so many victims that will never have their voices chronicled. And I guess there's nothing you can do about it, but it does tell you just how, you know, incredibly vast this experience has been, and we only understand, you know, perhaps the most minute element of it, or most minute.
This is staggering. Stanley Hoffman, scholar at Harvard, has taught a big course for a million years on war, like from the first caveman to yesterday. His last course, I think, in his career, was on the war in Iraq. The most depressing experience he's ever had, he said, because it didn't seem the students got it, but in the policy planning of the war, his line to us was, they knew nothing, 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 and they didn't care to find out. Now, if anything could be worse, we may never find out.
And in fact,
Has there been a war like this before?
I tell you, part of me is convinced that, like I said a little bit earlier, that the legacy of this war is that the Americans are going to come away and say, we figured out how to win wars like this. And I think, I mean, if there's a worse lesson you could take away from it, I'm willing to hear it. But I think it's just spectacular that we don't appreciate the devastation that has been wrought in Iraq over the past 7 or 8 years. It's just spectacular. In my mind, a society has been destroyed at some level. Is it going to turn out all right in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years? You know, it may. It doesn't feel that way to me right now. It feels as precarious and as dangerous and as unsettled as it ever has. In fact, it reminds me of 2003 in some ways. You know, there was an incredible amount of arrogance, I think, that went into this entire experience, you know, on the part of journalists, on the part of policymakers, on the part of the military. But it was that arrogance where, like you just pointed out, there wasn't even a desire to learn. And, you know, to the point where, you know, you're answering, and I have a lot more respect for the diplomats there today than I did back in 2003. In 2003, it was absurd, you know, how awful American officials were there. But today you do have some diplomats who will speak Arabic who have more experience in the region. But even then, they'll be asking questions that were the same questions you heard back in 2003. And it does give you pause of, like, where are we at after all these years and basically having inherited a country?
There are aspects of the war that you write about, but we don't know enough about, except the U.S. military did. I remember it's 3 years ago, probably, when they were writing the counterinsurgency manual at Fort Leavenworth, one of the principal authors said to us on the radio, Chris, it's right out of Thucydides. Go back and read Thucydides' account of the civil war at Corcyra, now the resort island of Corfu. But he said you can practically see the drill bits in the head. A society just coming apart under the pressure of war. You write about it in the most shocking ways. I mean, the dismemberment of people. You know, yesterday they were sort of civilized members of the community, and today they're tearing a man's head off and leaving it on a spike for 3 days. What did you learn from that? What should we learn from that? Except, other than go back to Thucydides, it's all thousands of years old.
Yeah, I wonder. Well, that's a good question. I'm trying to think if I've learned anything about war and all this. I don't know if I've taken away any of these, you know, if I've taken away larger truth, to be honest, about war, violence. You know, I do think I understand something that, I guess that, you know, one thing that I do maybe understand a little bit better that I didn't before I went is, you know, how powerful these notions of survival can become. You know, a good friend of mine in Beirut once put it to me that, you know, he was trying to explain why this sectarian, I mean, Lebanon's another example, 120,000 dead in a barbaric 15-year civil war, for what? I mean, it's, you know, basically didn't change much in the end. And he was trying to explain to me how sectarian conflict could be so pitched, how it could be so violent, how it could be so devastating. And he said, you know, no community in Lebanon has a guarantee of survival. And I think, you know, that just becomes a psychological thing as much as a strategic thing. And I think that's what we saw in Iraq in some ways, is that there was, in some ways, an existential war that was being fought in 2006 and 2007. And, you know, that war had, obviously, that war had no limits. Mm.
Go back to your friend Mullah Nadhim in Thuluia. Was it he that spoke of, the phrase that jumped out of your copy was, the Neanderthal in a globalized age? Was he describing himself?
You know, he was describing what he could have perhaps become if he hadn't changed his mind, changed his perspective. Mullah Nadhim was a very intelligent man. There's no question about it. Was he opportunist? I mean, I think it's his track record shows that he was. Was he perhaps, you know, savvy enough to, like, you know, to do good through that opportunism? Perhaps. Did he have blood on his hands? Absolutely. He was one of the most complicated, and that's what I liked about him. He was so complicated. Hmm. You know, good or bad, I have no idea. He's a mix. He's, you know, I'm not sure I quite understood him in the end. But, you know, that was his point, was that, you know, we can't, you know, what Al-Qaeda was trying to bring to this village, or at least what he saw as trying to bring to this village in the end, was this, you know, almost kind of medieval sense of a place that had it enter into the modern age, and he rebelled. And now that's his explanation of why he rebelled. I mean, I think some of it had to do with he understood he would lose all, you know, all popular support if he did not make that rebellion. But, you know, was it sheer opportunism? Was it, you know, was it more strategic, more principled? I think it's probably a mix of both. But, you know, together they did create this very complicated person that I think, you know, I don't think we've heard the last of.
If he's the representative man in the representative town, I mean, how does that story continue, do you think?
You know, I think it's interesting how he is, you know, where his power came from. And I think that's something that, you know, is going to have a huge impact in Iraq in the coming years. You know, his power came from basically being a cleric. He had, you know, the power of religion behind him. It also had a lot to do with the men, you know, men with armed men that he had behind them. And I think, you know, then there are rumors of where he, you know, that he had money, the contributions that come his way. And I think this idea of power, you know, of guns, God, and money it's going to be a formula that, you know, I keep coming back to this word that you use, but, you know, it can be somewhat toxic, but it also can be very influential and very, you know, relevant, I think, in politics right now. You know, there's this notion, I think, and I think Mullah-Nothem's an example of this somehow. You know, again, as the Americans leave, or, and I put leave in quotation marks, but the Americans, you know, to some extent leave or disengage from Iraq, there's this notion out there that they've set down the rules. And there's also this notion, I think, that, you know, that the United States would say that people are going to follow those rules. And I think that's where the problem rests. I don't think there is an inclination on the part of the political class in Iraq right now, or even people like Mullah-Nothem, to play by those rules. If you can find a way around those rules and achieve your objective, that's a perfectly legitimate way to go about business. I think that comes, you know, we can apply that to somebody as, you know, somebody like Mullah-Nothem is probably, I think it sounds like he's running for his life right now, but may very well come back. All the way up to Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, you know, will he really surrender power? And I think that's an open question. I think it's a much more open question than people acknowledge right now, if he'll step down peacefully.
Remind me, what are the American rules that we want them to live by?
You know, you go to the ballot box, you choose a person, that person takes power, the person who was voted out leaves, and, you know, and power, you know, changes hands peacefully and comprehensively. You know, all the talk, I think, before the election was about de-bathification. How do we get rid of the Ba'ath Party? Or, like, you know, some of the more religious candidates trying to get rid of the Ba'ath Party, this process they call de-bathification. I think the question is going to become, if Maliki, Prime Minister Maliki, loses power, de-Malikization. How do you get rid of Maliki's people? And he has put his people throughout you know, they man the instruments of power in Iraq today. Are they going to give up those instruments easily? And I think that is, you know, I think that's one of the most pressing questions right now in the country today.
What do you make of this moment in 2010 when at least the formal doctrine is Iraq was the wrong war, Afghanistan is the right one? Sort of let's move a few hundred miles east and try it again.
Yeah. You know, I've covered Afghanistan not very much. I've been there twice. I was there in 1997 when the Taliban were in power, and then I was back in 2002. And the little I do know about Afghanistan, I find, again, it's these same notions, I think, of arrogance and ignorance that bedeviled the experience in Iraq. I think they still feel that they're very much a part of the narrative in Afghanistan today. You know, how does that play out? I don't see I'm not sure how you measure victory in these places first, and or what constitutes victory. But even if we came up with a notion of what victory would you know, how we would represent victory, it's very hard for me to imagine us getting to that point ever.
Hmm. When will we find out? When will we come to terms with?
You know, I don't think we'll know for a generation what we've done to Iraq. I think that's putting it optimistically. You know, I think there's going to be a lot of talk right now when people start writing the epitaphs about the American experience in Iraq, that we left a, you know, somewhat functioning democracy behind in a very fragile place. And I find that very naive. You know, I think, you know, we've left behind a place that's traumatized and brutalized, and one that we help traumatize and brutalize. And does it recover? Can it recover? I think those are probably the more pressing questions. I think in some ways there's an existential question out there, and it's that, you know, has a country been so destroyed that it can't reconstitute itself?
Can we get at the story? Can reporters like you get at the story outside the green zone? All through the war, I wondered, is anybody out there listening, you know, beyond the American fortress?
You know, I've been impressed. I have to say that the journalists that are my colleagues today in Iraq, I give almost all of them credit for their, I think, and I don't want to, you know, be too self-congratulatory on this, but nearly all the colleagues I think in Iraq at this point are people who have been there for a long time, mm-hmm. and who have a certain commitment to the story. And I think a lot of them would say the same thing that I might be saying, is that you, just because the war is supposedly over doesn't mean it's time for us to leave. And I think it'd be tough for any of them to say, well, we're going to go to Afghanistan now and cover another war.
Can you get to the story? Can you get to villages, people?
Oh, I see what you're saying. In that sense, you know, you can now, in a way, I think you can get to that. I think I'd answer it in two ways. You know, and the first kind of comes off this idea of journalists being there a long time. You can get to it if you have the experience and knowledge. And then physically, just the logistics of it, you can get to it in a way that you couldn't since 2004, probably. It's a wide open place again. I mean, you can go. Mm. You know, I tried to go back to the Loya, this town, in 2006. And 2006, we went three times to a nearby town, Balad, and tried to negotiate some kind of promise of our, you know, safety. And each time we were, you know, they just said, we can't guarantee your safety if you try to go into this place. So if there was a period from 2005 to 2007 that I could not go back to the Loya, I did go back at the end of 2008. And I think at this point in 2010, you can pretty much go anywhere you want. So again, we're back to this, you know, this story can be told now. I think the question is just, is there a commitment to tell that story?
Hmm. I'd love to hear about your own life in Baghdad recently. What was it like? How close to the people were you? Was it all American cafeteria food, or were you out there?
You know, it's interesting. I think of journalism before 2001 and journalism after 2001. And, you know, since 2001, it's just been, there's not been a lot of the ordinary in anything that's gone on. I mean, you know, 2002, I was shot in the West Bank.
Remind me.
It was covering the Israelis had reoccupied parts of the West Bank, and I was in Ramallah, and I was shot by an Israeli sniper in the back. After that, I got divorced. After that, I got remarried, and then my wife, Netta Beckley, she came with me to Baghdad. And I think back to all these years, and just that ordinary has been so elusive, and it's been conflict after conflict, you know, so much war. And when Netta and I got married and decided to go basically on our honeymoon to Baghdad, you know, there was a sense of like, can we finally create some kind of ordinary life or something that's somewhat normal? And, you know, we managed, and weirdly, I mean, you're living in a place with a lot of other people. It feels a little bit too much like a fraternity house. But, you know, Netta and I just made a decision that at a certain time, 9 or 10 o'clock, we're going to shut our door and just kind of retire into, you know, in our room and spend time together and try to, you know, create something that, you know, I guess evoke the suburban life. Didn't quite manage it, I have to be honest.
Was this in the green zone?
This was actually not. We had a house outside the green zone. We had a house that, you know, in fact, the house that we were staying in the most recent bombings, or not most recent, but in the big bombings that happened in January, the house was pretty much destroyed, to be honest. Mm. It was miraculous that nobody was badly hurt in that. Netta and I had by that point gone to the New York Times. But in that same bombing, I mean, Netta, you know, she was pregnant during her time there, and I think she was 7 months pregnant when those bombs went off, shattered every window in our house. You know, and you sat there for, you know, it's one of those moments where, you know, as much as you really wanted to, like, try to create something ordinary in a place that is much more, I mean, it's much less violent today, but it is still violent. You know, you sit there for a moment and you know, you kind of look at each other and you want to sit there and talk about what's just happened and, you know, you want to make sure everybody's okay. And, you know, you're a journalist and, you know, I think we made sure each other's okay. And then 2 minutes later, you know, I head to the bomb site to, you know, try to cover a story that nobody's going to read, to be honest. And people are so worn out of reading about violence in Iraq that just another day story on a bombing doesn't have all that much impact, to be honest.
Were you targets?
We weren't. Our house was in between the Hamra Hotel and the Babel Hotel. So I think it was probably about a kilometer away from each, and the bombs went off just a few minutes apart. So I think it was the second bomb that shattered all our windows. A lot of other journalists were at the... They had their houses near. They were either staying at the Hamra Hotel or had their houses near the Hamra Hotel, like the Washington Post. And that bomb was actually right next to the Hamra Hotel, and that's why it destroyed the Washington Post office. You know, was it targeted? I think that Hamra Hotel was targeted because journalists were there. Yes.
What do you credit for the decline of violence in Baghdad, and how long is it going to last?
It's a good question, and I think that, you know, again, this is, you know, there's a lot of people attribute it to the surge. I think the surge is probably the least if any. I mean, it had some impact, but it was definitely, it's probably more of a psychological impact in some ways. I think the insurgents always figured the Americans were going to leave. You know, as the Americans pulled out of Beirut in 82 after the, or 83 after the Marine barracks bombing, I think there was a notion in Iraq that the Americans were going to leave too if there was enough pressure put on them. I think psychologically the surge said that wasn't the case, and it did. I think it did have a bearing on things that were, I think the insurgent sense of their self. I think it was a tangential factor in some ways. I think what the strategic factors were this awakening movement where the tribes in Anbar turned against al-Qaeda, and I think also the decision by the Sadrists, the followers of Muqtada Sadr, to stand down, to accept some kind of truce or ceasefire. You do get the sense that everybody's, you know, it's not, I mean, I think it's a respite rather than a resolution. I think it's a lull probably more than anything else. Can people rearm themselves and take to fighting? I think absolutely, although I think the very nature of the conflict has changed at this point. It's a much more political one than as I, you know, as I mentioned earlier, much more political than, say, existential.
Or religious.
I mean, I think it's clear that, you know, in this sectarian war and in this sectarian sense of identity that has emerged in Iraq today, very sadly, the Shia did win the war. And I think even the Sunnis acknowledge that to some point. You know, what hasn't been resolved, though, is this political question. Who's going to rule the country? You know, who is going to be in power and what coalition is going to dominate?
Who's going to own the oil?
I think that's another question. I think, you know, and what arrangement, you know, is that oil controlled? It's every fundamental question in the country has yet to be answered, and there's no question about that.
What do you take to be the Obama team's design for all this? What are the professionals now really up to?
You know, I think that's a good question. I mean, I guess, and I'll speak just about Iraq because it's the only thing I feel, you know, it's the only place I can speak with any authority on. But I think in Iraq, what's so interesting to me is that it's, you know, this administration does not consider Iraq their war or its war. And it's, you know, that has a lot of implications, I think. I mean, you see it as in terms of the embassy where there's not a lot of direction coming from Washington. It's more Washington wants to know that, you know, things are going okay. You know, we're headed toward a withdrawal.
No news is good news. Don't mess it up.
Exactly. And, you know, to the point where the election was like there was this overwhelming desire on the part of the administration to portray the elections as going very smoothly, that this moment has passed. It's a milestone on our way to withdrawal. In fact, it was a very violent day. It was a very unsettled day, in fact. And there's a lot more violence than the Americans were willing to acknowledge. But you knew that the narrative was so in place that here's the milestone that inaugurates our withdrawal and we're on our way, that it's starting to get a little, you know, it actually got in the way of the truth a little bit. But that is the overwhelming notion, I think, right now. Close the door, you know, behind you, hopefully lock it. There's always going to be some kind of engagement going on. It still is the biggest embassy in the world. There's vast oil resources that are going to be coveted. But is this, you know, is the, in terms of the conflict, in terms of the military engagement, it is quite clearly over. I think what we're going to see in the years ahead, though, is, you know, again, and this is one of the truths I think you can take away from America, is this conflict has changed. There's been so many permutations to it over the years. And I think it will be another conflict in the years ahead over what kind of U.S. military presence remains in Iraq. I mean, you know, will the Americans have entirely withdrawn from Iraq by the end of next year as they're supposed to? I don't think they will. And I think there you could see a very interesting kind of conflict emerge over that presence.
Interesting. So fascinating that you get your Pulitzer between employment for the Washington Post and a new job with the New York Times. I'd love you to spell out some of the implications there.
You know, I don't think the New York Times or the Washington Post were all that crazy about it. I mean,
what do you mean?
Well, I think the New York Times had their own, you know, they had nominated their own people to win the prize. And I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, they think they should want their own people to win it. And wasn't, you know, the Post, you know, hadn't nominated. Actually, you know, I put the entry in myself, to be honest, because I felt like I wanted to. That body of work to, you know, didn't want to necessarily win the prize, but I wanted to somehow to recognize it maybe on my own terms. And so I don't think the Post was crazy about it either. So you kind of feel like a little bit alone, you know, out there in the wilderness. And I was completely, I did not whatsoever expect it to ever win. I mean, like I said, it was my own kind of way of maybe giving it the recognition I wanted
to. There's a very distinctive touch in your work. It's not at all typical of what we read in newspapers these days. It's long, it's detailed, sometimes it's more than you want to know about people that you've never met, then you're not sure how to pronounce their names either. But they indulged you in heroic work. I'm glad they were rewarded. I also wonder if you can do the same thing For the foreign desk of the New York Times.
And I think that's a good... Can you do it for the Post even anymore? And I wonder about that. I think, you know, I think there was a time... It's funny that, you know, I sound like a, you know, this cagey veteran of journalism. I mean, I've been doing it, you know, for 15, 20 years. And I think, I feel like I may have already passed the golden age of that journalism. I mean, there was a period, and, you know, think back to my old editors, Phil Bennett, David Hoffman, where we're going to do a kind of journalism no one's ever done before. We're going to, you know, we're going to tell a story, develop a narrative that no one's going to come close to. You know, is that ambition still out there? I think it's more about survival at this point. How's this newspaper going to get through to the next year and not go bankrupt, or is not going to fold? I think ambition has gone down a little bit. I think, as you pointed out, you know, some readers aren't in there for the 2,500-word story, and stories across the board are written much shorter now. You know, they're told, I think, in a more, you know, I think that notion of narrative is probably, you know, scale back a little bit. I think the stories are told in a more kind of...
Your stories are like chapters of a forthcoming book. I wonder, I mean, is the New Yorker magazine standing there ready in case you need them?
You know, I tell you, my favorite thing to do, even to this day, is to go work on a story for 3 or 4 days and write, you know, as long as they'll let me write. I still feel that it's a very fulfilling way of telling a story or of doing journalism. You know, is it going to be fulfilling in 2, 3, you know, 5 years? Probably not. But for now, I still find it that it's the best way to tell the story that I want to tell. You know, I think back in one of the stories I did just a few months ago in December, you know, it's a story that I wrote. I think it was less than 1,000 words. And all I wanted to do was go to this American base and find out what was left behind. I just wanted to go through the trash, basically. And I got to write that story. And, you know, again, this wasn't a story that went 3,000 words. It didn't have a lot of characters. It was basically just reporting. You know, it was just observation. It was 1,000 words. And I felt like I told more with that than I could tell with a 3,000 or 4,000 word story. So I think the form, it's still out there. You know, I think, like I said, I think ambition in journalism in general, in American journalism, traditional American print journalism, you know, has been scaled down just because it is a crisis these days. But you can still tell that story. You can get out there and do what you want with it. And, you know, to be honest, at some level, we're pretty lucky to still be able to do it. I mean, I think this is, you know, I think I'm part of the last generation of that traditional foreign correspondent. I guess I might as well do it as long as they'll let me do it.
What does the New York Times think it's getting? And what is their notion of your assignment?
Well, I think they want someone that, you know, that will tell the story with a certain authority and a certain experience and knowledge that, you know, can bring a certain, I don't want to say closure or resolution, but, you know, can speak to the experience of several years in Iraq. I mean, this is the journalism that is written in Iraq these days is about some notion of the end. It doesn't have to be an American end or an Iraqi end, but there is some notion of the end that informs almost every story, I think, written about Iraq these days. And I think for the New York Times, you know, somebody that can understand that end or that maybe has a sense of that end is going to is going to help the coverage. And I'm not speaking just about me. I think everyone on the staff at this point has the experience or has the years in the country to be able to do that.
What is their expectation of so-called objectivity? And particularly where it's a stock and trade of yours that you bring an Arab sensitivity to Arab culture, Arab ways.
I've never really understood that idea of objectivity. I mean, I think it's absurd. I mean, I think what we really want to do with journalism is, I mean, I think there is a notion of fairness. I think there's a sense of being fairness. And I've often looked at a story and I'm like, am I being fair here? You know, am I? But I guess I've always, you know, I never really, and even beyond those terms, objectivity or fairness or that kind of thing, I've always found it more interesting. And I think hopefully the reader finds it interesting as well, is that I'm out there to answer a question that I've been asking myself. And I'm just trying to answer that question. You know, is it objective? Is it fair? Is it balanced? You know, those mean much less to me than am I answering this question? And I think, you know, in this piece about the Loya or this piece about the American base, not sure there would even be a notion of fairness or balance, but there would be a notion that, you know, we set out to answer a question.
I'm thinking also, and I'm sure you're aware of the questions that have been raised mostly online about Ethan Bronner, your Times colleague in Jerusalem, who's under some sort of fire for the fact that his son is enlisted in the Israeli Defense Forces. So can he cover the story at the same time? Does this tear at you at all?
Me personally, would I fall into that category?
Would your newborn son fight in an Arab army one day, and would you disqualify yourself from the story if he does?
You know, it's funny. My son, leave it to Lebanese law that he would not be Lebanese unless I get Lebanese citizenship. So he probably doesn't. Can't think of a worse army to want to enter than the Lebanese army. But you know, I think I tell you, when you talk about Ethan Bronner, you talk about even, you know, my situation as, you know, I think. I think especially with Israel and Palestine, that everything is so contested in that story, so unbelievably contested, from words to space to history to memory. That I, you know, I think Ethan is in a position I would not want to be in, and I would not put myself in covering that story with that
with those, family ties.
Yeah, those connections. You know, it's, you know, would I cover that? Let's say, you know, my wife was, you know, a member of Hezbollah or something like that. I don't think I would be allowed to cover it either. Cover Lebanon for that matter. You know, it's a tough, you know, where do you draw the line? Then the question becomes, though, and that's where I think it does get dangerous. Does, you know, because my cousin has this relationship, or you know, my wife was once quoted saying this, or my father does this. I mean, you do wonder where you do draw the line. But I think that story, Israel and Palestine, is so much more contested than any other story in the world, that by its very nature, I think it imposes a certain, an even higher standard on the journalists who cover it.
Who's your model, Anthony Shadid, when you think of, you know, heroic, maybe unreachable standards of international journalism?
You know, I tell you, this is funny. Since I was young and since I was in college, I always, you know, Richard Kapuscinski was the person I looked up to most. And I've been reading all this stuff where he was, you know, apparently accused of not always telling the truth. I don't know, that's a little shattering, actually, because I always held him up as like the greatest journalist of, or just the kind of standard. I mean, he was able, I'll never forget, there's this one passage, and I couldn't even quote it, and I read it so many years ago, but he's comparing the way that, I think it was Nasser, Nkrumah and Ture, I forget, I mean, people have a different generation, but he's just comparing how they spoke. And here's Kapuscinski, doesn't speak the languages, but the power of observation was so remarkable that I felt like I was sitting at these rallies listening to these men spoke. He didn't even understand the language. I mean, it's remarkable that he could hone his observation to that extent where you still felt like you were there. You know, I just there's something, you know, where journalism, I think, can still be transcendent, and that is the power of observation, you know, the power of storytelling. It's a medium that, you know, I think is often hackneyed and often trite, but I think it still can become transcendent. I think Kapuscinski is one of those examples where, you know, what does literary journalism mean? I'm not even sure what that means, but I think where journalism can become something more than the day-to-day grind, and it can say something that, you know, that might actually kind of ripen with age. You know, I think one of the most brilliant, insightful things I've ever read on the Middle East was a book called Mantle of the Prophet.
Yes.
Roy Mutahida.
Yes.
There's this one, and again, this is not to get too esoteric here, but he has this one passage in there about how this young cleric, you know, reaches this point of illumination, and I thought it was just breathtaking. And what was breathtaking about it was not the description was remarkable, but it was something that no one would necessarily believe when they were reading it, but he wrote it in such a sober, modest way that you did believe it. I mean, it was written not scientifically, but it was written so, I guess I could come back to this word, sober, that you felt as you were like as going along with this person as you reach this level of higher understanding. It's also so rich in terms of the context, the texture, the fabric of the place that, you know, I feel like I learned more out of that book than anything else I've ever read. There's definitely some beautiful stuff out there.
It's important that you tell it right, because we're going to have to see it more clearly before this generation of conflict, as you say, is going to be over.
You know, and it's, I tell you, it was interesting when I think about the 2003 war, the 2006 war, you know, in Lebanon. You know, I've always found it kind of, you know, who won, who lost, where's the front line, you know, what this battle did, what that battle did. You know, I always thought war was better understood as a backdrop to that kind of human story, that more that, you know, a very human narrative. And I, you know, tried to do that in 2003 with the invasion. In fact, you know, people who I'm still in touch with, this woman, mother of, I think she's a mother of seven, I forget now, six or seven, who had to send her son off to fight, and, you know, stayed with the family. And that, I thought we understood war so much better through her eyes. Or in 2006, I'll never forget, you know, sitting with a father who had lost his, you know, I forget how many children it was now, but it was eight. And I remember him yelling at one point, couldn't God have just left me one child? And I just, it was just wrenching. And I remember, you know, myself being just, you know, almost speechless after hearing something like that. And this, to me, is how we understand war. And, you know, is it judgmental? Is it, yeah, I mean, obviously, I mean, war is awful. But I think those are the lessons we maybe should learn, you know, from conflict and from violence.
Anthony Shadid, we wish you every good fortune and success, and we thank you for doing the job. It's impossible, and nobody comes closer that I can think of than you.
Well, I appreciate it. It's my pleasure. I mean, I feel almost embarrassed of talking so long about it, but I really appreciate it.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.